Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. Since the cancellation of the 2020 festival, we've been working hard to ensure that this year's program has a new story. Over the coming months, we'll be reimagining a significant number of sessions that were scheduled to take place on our festival stages as podcasts, bringing the writing, ideas, and debates from the 2020 program to online audiences around Australia and the world.
Hello and welcome to this Sydney Writers' Festival 2020 podcast. My name is Cassie McCullough and I co-host with Kate Evans, The Bookshelf, a weekly program and podcast about new fiction on ABC Radio National. I also present a weekday mid-morning program on ABC Radio Sydney, which delves into social, political and cultural affairs of the day. And it's a great pleasure to have discussed James Bradley's work on both of these programs and his interest in and concern for the world in which we find ourselves. And that's because, as we'll find out shortly, James has the rare talent for writing in an array of forms and for many audiences. And I'm delighted to have this opportunity to talk to him about his new novel, Ghost Species. But before I do, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which the Sydney Writers' Festival's events ordinarily take place, and also to pay my respects to elders past, present, and to come. Now, it's quite possible that you're already familiar with the work of Adelaide-born James Bradley. That's because he shot to prominence in 1997 when his first novel, Rack, was nominated for various awards, including the Miles Franklin and Australia's Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Book. His work now includes the novels The Deep Field, The Resurrectionist, Clade, and The Change Trilogy for young adults, as well as a book of poetry, Paper Nautilus, and The Penguin Book of the Ocean. His novels have won or been shortlisted for an embarrassment of major Australian and international literary awards and have been widely translated. On top of that, James is also an essayist and a reviewer, and back in 2012 he won the Pascal Prize for Australia's Critic of the Year. His new novel, Ghost Species, is published by Hamish Hamilton. James Bradley, hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you in this virtual space. And we're talking this way because of the great disruption of COVID-19. And so given that, it's worth noting that you were recently described by The Australian as Australia's literary Nostradamus. That was reviewer Jack Cameron Stanton. And that was because your book, Clade, had a couple of elements that proved to be rather prophetic. Can you describe those for us?
Oh, sure. Clade is a novel that's set over about 60 or 70 years, and it's about this one family kind of living through the effects of climate change. And in the second half of the book, one of the things that happens is there's a pandemic, which begins in China and is a SARS-like infection and kind of spreads around the world. And It was really eerie. In fact, I reread it about the time everything started to happen, and it was really very, very strange, the number of kind of coincidences between the two things. I mean, I don't see my fiction as narrowly predictive in that way, but it was just kind of odd to have that sense that there was something that I'd written about actually happening.
And it's also in Clade that we see the embryo of the idea for this new novel of yours, Ghost Species. And maybe I'm using the word embryo because there's all these ideas about reproduction and extinction. But in Clade, you even raise the term ghost species. It's a concept.
It is. I mean, the concept is this kind of idea of a species that has... Yeah, there are still individual specimens, but they can't reproduce. So there might only be males left or something like that. So the species is not yet extinct, but it's functionally extinct, if you see what I mean. And in Clade there's a section which is about the birds dying, the birds are disappearing. And I suppose that is a kind of bridge between the two books. I mean that kind of sense of this the kind of presence of extinction in the world, the kind of sense that species are slipping away, the sense of loss and that kind of connection to kind of personal loss is absolutely there. And in an odd kind of way, I do think the two books, you know, they are kind of companion books. I mean, Clade is a book that's trying to open up space to kind of think a series of things through, but then Ghost Species is I guess it's darker and possibly more despairing cousin, if that makes sense.
They're both standalone, but yes, there is this thread that appears to go through them. It's interesting to hear you call it a dark cousin. So two Ghost Species and the initial setup, where we find this couple in the beginning of Ghost Species heading to a compound. It's forested, it's lush, it's Tasmania, it's beautiful. And there's a private area that's been bought by this billionaire. His name is Hucker. Hucken. And I have to say, he did remind me of Elon Musk for some reason. Was there any hint of Musk in your character?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of Musk in the character. The character's called Davis Hucken. There's a bit of Mark Zuckerberg in there as well, obviously. And, like, there's that kind of idea that Hucken, you know, huckster, all that kind of sense of these kind of billionaires who are so wealthy that around them kind of the laws of gravity have suspended. They can do whatever they want. I mean, their kind of insane wealth makes them into kind of gods. And I was really interested by the idea of these people for whom, you know, we kind of allow them to kind of experiment with our world, and we confuse their kind of massive wealth for a kind of genius. And I was interested in this guy who was immensely wealthy and was therefore seen as a kind of genius, but perhaps he's not. Perhaps he's just a person like us.
Mm-hmm. He's just a man with a lot of money.
He's a man.
And some crazy ideas. Yeah. And so this couple, Kate and Jay, become involved in the care of this Neanderthal girl, this little baby girl who has been brought back through, as you described, you know, the wonder of science. And the all too human, or is that Neanderthal thing, happens and bonding occurs. And but the idea of that of Hucker is to what? What's he trying to do?
Well, I thought he was, I mean, Davis, the billionaire, he has this kind of idea that if what we could do is we could create another human species, we could see ourselves through their eyes and we might begin to reimagine the world differently. Because if suddenly we're no longer the only human species, we have to kind of realize that we're not singular, we're not different, we're not separated from nature. So he has this kind of idea that if he could bring all of these creatures back, he could somehow, you know, change the way we relate to the world. But also more than that, he's got this kind of notion that somehow because of our immense power, because of our immense wealth, because of our technology, we're suddenly put in a position of being able to kind of reshape and control the world. And what he does is he kind of confuses the capacity to shape the world with the right to shape the world. You know, he confuses the capacity to shape the world with the ability to control the world, which seems to me to be a really important distinction. So he has got this kind of idea that he can bring these people, these creatures back, then we can kind of reshape our relationship with the planet.
Mm-hmm. So instead of actually addressing the harmful practices that we may be undertaking, we just find new ones and the problem is solved in that way, although you say it isn't. So we find ourselves in a world which is identifiably Australia, but there's also something else that has been happening in the background of this novel. How do you describe that? It's a disruption, a kind of breaking down of society as we know it.
Yeah, I mean, the novel is set against the backdrop of a kind of hastening climate catastrophe. And one of the things I wanted very much to do with the novel was to, because the novel's quite, in an odd kind of way, quite domestic and quite focused on this kind of relationship that's at the centre of it. And they're removed from society in many ways because they're up in the wilderness. And I wanted that sense that the world is kind of unravelling around them in the background. You know, because I kind of loved that idea, which I think is something that happens, that sense that the end of the world is kind of happening all around us all the time, but it tends to be happening just over there. We watch it on our televisions, you know, we watch it on our phones, we kind of experience it through the internet, and it's never quite here. It's just over the hill until suddenly it kind of is here. And that's what happens in the second half of the book.
Mm. Not with a bang, but a whimper, the kind of fragmentation.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really, I really wanted to try and capture in the book, is that sense that, you know, although the end, if it comes, might be quite quick, it's also part of it. You know, as someone said to me recently, when the end comes, it's going to be really quick, but it's also going to be slow. It'll be both. It'll be fast and slow at the same time. So it'll be this process of kind of gradual breakdown and then quite sudden kind of eruptions of change. I mean, and we saw that happen in Australia over the last 6 months. I mean, what you saw with the fires was you saw this kind of moment of kind of rupture where suddenly we hit this kind of catastrophe and something happened really fast. And you could kind of see, I mean, I found all of that quite disturbing, because what you could see was the way things can be kind of normal but not quite right. You know, you're getting fish die-offs, you're getting drought, you're getting all these, and quite suddenly something can happen. You know, and I guess the book was trying to get at that sense of pervasive unease that can suddenly coalesce into sudden change.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that you've written about in your non-fiction work as well. And I was referring earlier to a discussion we'd had, and that was with Cameron Muir, another writer in this area. And we were talking about the despair that is almost unavoidable when you see the destruction that human beings are wreaking all around us. And you know, it could be fires, it could be the pollution of plastic or in our rivers and food chains or everything. And each one of these things individually should break our heart. The fires, it's hard not to think, should have been a point where we all stopped and went, okay, it's here, it's enough, we need to do something. But yet somehow we turn our heads away and we don't want to look at it. It's maybe a human instinct, but not one that you have. You like to look at it. Why is that?
I mean, I think one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to think about those processes of denial, that way that we don't let ourselves see what's around us. And when you're dealing with things like climate change and kind of environmental catastrophe, that's a very natural response. I mean, the situation is so terrible that we get very good at kind of compartmentalizing it and thinking, well, I kind of know how bad things are rationally, but I don't let myself think about it too much. You know, or if I do think about it, I don't think about it for very long, you know, because it's so upsetting, because it's so difficult, because it's so traumatic to think about. But what happens is you end up with this kind of dissonance in your life where you kind of know what's going on, but you don't let yourself know. And I guess what I was trying to do was to think about, at what point does pretending that everything's going to be okay when you know things are not going to be okay become a kind of another form of denial. So I was trying to think that through. I also think, look, I mean, I think one of the things that's very noticeable, just to kind of make a political point, that's been really noticeable over the last few months, is what you saw with the fires was this moment of complete catastrophe, this moment where, as you say, things should have changed. We should have looked around ourselves and thought, this has to stop. You know, this is enough. This has to be a moment of change. But what you in fact saw was the kind of machinery of denial kind of kicking into place again, you know, bots on social media talking about arsonists. I mean, all of that, that kind of process. And what's been really interesting about the pandemic is that hasn't happened, you know, because what you haven't got is a kind of organized denial industry at work. So just to kind of make that kind of point, I think people like me often end up talking about kind of psychological things, but what you mustn't forget is that there's actually these kind of real world political structures at work all the time.
Yes. And the diffusion of reality seems to be very easy, but maybe not in this case, or at least not in this part of the world, thank goodness. The idea of an existential dread's been around for some time, but I guess you could argue now it is now the backdrop to all writing, to all art, to all conversations, to everything. And to actually not be discussing it is neither here nor there, because this world is now influencing every part of our lives, creative and other.
I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the things that's really noticeable is the degree to which this conversation kind of leaks into everything. And that's partly about the nature of climate change. I mean, it's a massive thing that goes on everywhere. It touches everything. And I mean, particularly, you know, you can see that it's, you know, it's kind of affected our politics in Australia in a massive way over the last 15 years. You can see that it's kind of invading every aspect of our kind of cultural lives. But you can kind of feel that, you know, that kind of sense of floating dread, that sense of floating breakdown is kind of all around us. And, you know, and it's connected to that sense that, you know, the of kind of ongoing political breakdown, of political stratification, of all of these things, that they're all kind of tied up together. This kind of sense of free-floating unease and fear is very powerful. And I guess that's one thing that the book's trying to do. It's trying to capture that somehow, to kind of get that sense of this moment of kind of free-floating crisis.
Mm-hmm. And inside of that, as you point out, there are just human relationships going on. So here we have Jay and Kate, their relationship. I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, it's being tested. There's other past relationships that are coming on. So you've written this rather amazing book about a place that seems so real it could be today, with identifiable characters from the culture around us, like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg, with the technology debate, and it's a thriller, and you're examining these really fundamental human relationships. It's quite an extraordinary feat that you've pulled off.
Oh, thank you. I mean, one of the things I really liked about the book was that sense that it kind of constantly mutates. So it begins as a kind of, you know, it feels like a kind of Jurassic Park thriller, and then it becomes a kind of on-the-run book, and then it becomes a book about growing up, and then it becomes a kind of end-of-the-world book. So I love that sense that there's this kind of constant kind of shifting of the kind of book it is as it goes along, as it evolves. And also, one of the things I really want to do was to find a language. And when I was writing it, I was looking for a kind of language which felt, I wanted the book as a whole to feel kind of like you were skipping a stone through time, but this sense that it was just sitting on the cusp of reality. So it was this sense that it felt, it was very weightless, but also kind of right now. You could feel that happening in the kind of prose. So that was really quite deliberate.
Yes, and there's many references to contemporary thinkers and ideas and references that make you do feel very grounded in the here and now, which gives that extra frisson of slight disturbing, ooh, this could be happening, this could be us now. And I mentioned that the embryo of the idea being in clade, and I actually mean that quite in a not just a metaphorical way, I suppose, because the character that we meet did I say Jay before? Do I mean Adam?
In clade, it's Adam.
Okay, right, yeah. The character that we think might be a continuation in these books, although they're completely standalone and not related overtly, there is the question of IVF and a failed attempt at that. And then we have this child being born out of a similarly scientific process. So there is this idea flowing through of reproduction and that idea that you already explained about the ghost species, the species that continues only in its last remnants and not really one that's going to flourish, or maybe it will. So why this concern? I mean, this is a universal thing. Is this a concern that you think about a lot yourself, that, reproducing yourself into a world like this? I know that you're a father, so, you know, I think parents and non-parents think about these things. People who choose not to have children sometimes are concerned with the future that we might be leaving behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of, so both books, as you say, I mean, clade begins with a kind of question around IVF and this couple having a child, and in an odd kind of way, ghost species begins in the same place. It's about this kind of sense of anxiety and difficulty around children and the creation of children. I think that kind of all of those questions around parenthood and children and where we go from here become incredibly fraught when you think about these problems. I mean, I know that with my kids, you know, it's over the last 5 or 10 years, it's gotten harder and harder. I mean, you want to feel hopeful for the world they're going into, but it's harder and harder to do that. And so I wanted the books to kind of think about that idea of what do you do when you start to worry about the future that your kids are going into, when you begin to know that at a kind of rational level it's going to be worse than the world you lived in. That becomes very difficult. But I also think one of the things that's really interesting is if you look at, there's now quite a lot of fiction in this space, and I do think that idea of family and parenthood and the kind of symbol of the family, the ordering structure of the family and its disruption has become one of the ways we think about and talk about this kind of larger disruption of climate change and the kind of disruption of the family unit, the loss of members of that unit, the difficulties around children become a way of thinking about the larger kind of social and environmental and ecological disruption of climate change.
And what you've just said really does reveal exactly how you move in this book from fast-paced, as you say, almost thriller-like styles to these profound questions of who we are and why we are here and what we're going to do with the time we do have here. Now, James, your book was written under some sad personal circumstances. You lost both your father and your mother in the process of this book coming to be. Can you tell us about that?
So I began the book in 2017, right around the time my father was dying, and he was sick for, I don't know, 18 months or so, and then eventually died. And in the space of about 6 weeks, he died, my friend Georgia Blaine died, and then my agent, who I've known for many years in the UK and who was exactly the same age as me, actually died. And so I guess I'd kind of been thinking about this book, and I wanted to write about this kind of sense of time and its disruption, this kind of sense of the weirding of the world. But I found myself kind of grappling with a whole lot of much more personal stuff, I think, around kind of grief and around parents, you know, and thinking about parenting and children and things like that. And then over the time I was writing it, my mother, who had been sick for a while, got sicker and sicker, and eventually, in fact, about a month before the book was published, died. So the book was kind of framed quite very much by that kind of weird midlife thing where you're surrounded by death, but simultaneously you've got, you know, I've got kids who are growing up. So you're kind of in the thick of parenting and doing all of that stuff around, you know, your life and living it as it goes along, while also these kind of seismic kind of changes and kind of seismic kind of losses are happening around you. So the book is very much, I think, about trying to find a way of thinking about both that kind of sense of kind of personal grief and personal loss, how we process it, how we think about it, or what sense we can make of it, but also trying to use that as a way of thinking about a kind of larger process of loss. I mean, this kind of sense that the world around us is fading away and disappearing, you know, I'm using very neutral language, is being killed by humans. One of the things I really want to do is to find a way of using those personal things and the larger things as ways of speaking back and forth to each other, if that makes sense. Mm.
Yes, it does. And you've written a beautiful piece for the Sydney Review of Books about the loss of your father. It's called An Ocean and an Instant, and I urge people to look it up. It's really just a profound description of your father and his departure, which, as you say, was in stages. But it also describes that profundity, but also the tiny little details at the same time. And right at the end, you say, something along the lines of, even when he's just gone, the memories already, the details already fading away, and you would, you know, if only you'd asked about this, and just that sense of trying to hold on to something and someone who's just on the other side, and that being impossible. And I feel that sense is infused in your book, that there's this window we're going through, and, you know, we may make attempts to, you know, like the Neanderthal child, you know, we may make attempts to restart things artificially, but we can't hide from this certainty that nothing is permanent.
Nothing is. I mean, that kind of process of erasure is part of life. You know, that sense that you lose people, you lose places, things disappear. I was trying to remember this morning something about some detail of my past, and I thought, oh well, I can ask my mother, and then I thought, well, actually, I can't, because she's not there anymore, and she'd be the only person now who'd know the answer to that question, you know. So there's, you know, I was trying to remember whether we lived for a while when I was first born at this house before we moved to that house, and those kind of ridiculous practical things, but I mean that sense of losing things, of kind of things being wiped away, is so much a part of our life at the moment. You know, that sense that every time you turn around, the world seems more diminished. Every time you turn around, there seem to be, you know, and in the essay you're talking about, I was trying to think about that sense that, you know, the kind of natural world that I knew was, I was slipping away. That sense that when I was a kid, there were geckos on the walls, there were skinks everywhere, you know, there was that kind of sense of life, there were lots of fish still in the sea and all that kind of thing, and that's kind of gone already, you know, that's already slipped away in the space of my life, you know, and so that kind of trying to think about that process of erasure and disappearance and think about the ways in which that echoes that kind of personal process of loss, that sense that we lose the people around us and they slip away and we lose something, but they don't go, in a sense. There is that sense also that extinction and personal extinction are linked by this sense that people don't entirely disappear. They become a kind of living absence, if that makes sense. They become, someone was asking me about this the other day, I think I said in that essay, they become a kind of unpresence. And that's one of the things the book's very much about, that idea of this ghost species, this kind of presence that's there but is no longer there.
Yes, and you make me think there about the fragility that of, but yeah, things that seem permanent and immovable are actually so fragile. But you made me think of the Tasmanian tiger that haunts us all. And just recently, some more footage turns up of this creature that you would dearly love. You would dearly love to see, not even just, you know, you want to see it in the wild. You don't want to see it in a zoo, but you know, just this little bit of fragment of footage. Is, you know, such a talisman of something gone. So each extinction is a loss of something immense. And as we know, and as you point out, extinctions are happening to us around us all the time, and we kind of accept it. We don't fight against it perhaps enough. Well, how do you cheer yourself up, James Bradley, when you are contemplating these ideas? I mean, do you have a black sense of humour? Do you have to sort of sweep it away sometimes?
I'm actually quite a cheerful person, and I have a sense of humour that gets me into trouble endlessly because I'm never very good about limits. I'm getting better finally as I get older, but, you know, I've never been very good at knowing when the joke should stop, which has been a source of continual problem for me. It is funny, though. I mean, all that stuff you were asking about, that essay before, and that kind of sense that you... Writing that essay was very, very difficult for me because one of the things I was trying to write about was my father, and I was trying to write about, you know, who was a very particular kind of person, shall we say, you know, and who I loved very much. But he was, you know, he was quite a difficult person in many ways. And when I wrote it, one of the things I really wanted to do was to be true to how I remembered him and to how I felt about him and to what he was like. And I did something I don't normally do. I talked to my brothers and my stepmother about the piece before it was published and kind of checked. And I felt when I finished it that I'd been very true to him. And I realized, you know, a few months after it was published, you know, it kind of dawned on me that he would have hated it. Mm-hmm. He would have seen it as the most incredible betrayal, that piece. You know, so that kind of sense of being true to things, you're not necessarily being true in a way that makes everyone happy. You know, but I mean, I think that that was also something I was trying to do in the book, was this sense that I wanted to find a way of writing where there was kind of no boundary between me and the work, if that makes sense, where, you know, you're writing in a very direct and kind of engaged way with the way you're, with the world you are. So it's about trying to dissolve boundaries. And so the book's very much written in the midst of this kind of sense of hastening catastrophe, you know, but it's about the hastening catastrophe we live in. So I was trying to kind of, I guess, process that sense of how we live at the moment into the kind of textures of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's very successful. There's a sense of the speeding upness of things and events happening beyond control and not in the minutely observed way they were at the beginning of the book. It's in a rush and things are going pear-shaped quickly. So does this, I'm interested by the fact that you write in so many forms and for so many different audiences, as I mentioned earlier. You've been actually nominated a couple of times for a science writing award and the criticism and this kind of reflection, your essays about the Anthropocene. And I'm just wondering, you know, why, how does this come out of you? How do you choose one form or another? What's the, when you sit down to write, you think, oh, what am I doing today? How does it come to you?
It's funny. I mean, I've always done lots of things, and that's partly kind of economic. I mean, I think lots of writers, you end up, you know, you write books, but the books don't make enough money to live off, obviously, and then you end up doing reviewing and writing articles and things. And I've always really liked that discipline of writing for newspapers and things. Like, I like that sense that you get sent something, you do it on time, it's got to be a certain length, it's got to meet certain sorts of expectations. I've always enjoyed that kind of, it's almost a kind of craft process, which I've always really enjoyed. I think also when you write big, long things like books, writing things like articles is great because you finish them in a couple of days and there's this lovely sense of finality, not that kind of endlessness of novels, which can take years to finish. But, I mean, certainly with I guess over the last probably 10 years, I've been doing more and more kind of essayistic writing and more writing, as you say, in a kind of science space. So stuff that is, you know, I've been nominated a couple of times, as you said, for like the Bragg Prize for science writing, which is probably not something I would have seen myself doing 10 or 15 years ago. And I mean, that came out of a couple of things. One was, I guess, finding new things to write about. I mean, I get very bored. I like to write about different things. I have lots of interests. I like to write about lots of different things. But it's also that the kind of space that the fiction started to come out of once I started to write about kind of climate questions, you know, one of the things you're doing in the fiction is trying to think about the textures. You're trying to think about what it's going to be like. You're trying to do this kind of imaginative work around imagining the effects of it and thinking it through. And there's really fantastic stuff, I think, that can come out of that. But an awful lot of what's going on around us is happening so fast and is so kind of intense and quick that I find that writing nonfiction in many ways is a better way to get at it. You know, it's that sense that you can kind of, you know, particularly if you're writing about things like bushfires or something, you know, novels about it are fantastic, but they take 3 years. You know, you can write an essay about it and kind of get something down that matters kind of fast. So, I mean, it's that sense that there's a kind of immediacy to the nonfiction, which I really like. And I guess different sorts of things suggest themselves in different ways. I mean, the choices usually make themselves about what form I'm going to write about it in, but it is that sense that there's a kind of, I guess, a kind of imaginative work you can do with the fiction, but then a kind of immediacy you can get with the non-fiction, which I really like.
You should try radio sometimes. It's the most immediate of all, I think. Scarily so sometimes. So you seem like your ideas have come just ahead of the rest of the world. And now we have this genre called cli-fi, or, you know, there's a range of different ways of describing fiction around ideas of reality, fiction around the science of what's happening now and also imagined scenarios. What do you make of that field and that genre? And do you see yourself within it, or do you kind of push away from it?
Well, I guess there's kind of two questions. I mean, there's the question about whether I, you know, I mean, I feel like once you write a book, it goes into the world, people should decide what they think it is. You know, it's not really up to you to classify it for them. So there's a level at which I don't think about those things. And when I'm writing, I don't think about those things either. I don't think of myself as a cli-fi writer or a science fiction writer. I think of myself as a novelist, you know, or a non-fiction writer. But I do think that one of the things that's really fascinating over the last 5 or 10 years is watching that, you know, the kind of the number of people who are now working in this space, the number of people who are trying to think through these ideas and engage with them, you know, and you have so much fantastic kind of urgent, you know, kind of exciting kind of writing happening in the space, which is trying to get to grips with these ideas that are incredibly difficult for us to think about, to try and capture, you know, I think the Jenny Offal book, which just came out, Weather, does an amazing job of trying to capture the textures of living in the moment, you know. I mean, it's about living a particular kind of privileged Western life, but it is about living in this kind of moment. And it seems to me that the fiction can do really great things about kind of making connections that are difficult to make in other ways, about imagining us forward in a way that's difficult to do in nonfiction, about trying to give shape to the kind of grief that I think a lot of us feel. And I think that's really useful. I mean, I think both because questions about climate are very difficult to think about. You know, they're big, they're hard to get your head around. Fiction gives you a way of doing it. But I actually think one of the things increasingly that you can do with fiction is I talked before about that kind of dissonance, that sense that we inhabit this weird space where we know what's going on, but we don't let ourselves know. And I think one of the things that fiction can do is it can let you sit in that space for a while and actually let go of all of the having to keep the other stuff at bay. You know, you can kind of encounter your anxieties, kind of think about your anxieties. So there's a kind of weird kind of way in which it lets us kind of move out of that space of denial and into something where we kind of recognize where we are. And I think that's really, really important.
Yes, and it's been interesting to watch not only people writing more and more with this in their stories, in the background of their stories. And I'm thinking actually of the very recent book by Robbie Arnott called The Rain Heron. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but he's a Tasmanian who the background of this rather extraordinary story is also some kind of disruption to the world order that is climate-based. So yeah, it's there in just this most recent book. But it's also what we reach for, and we're looking at people on Twitter and on social media trying to grapple with this pandemic and also with the fires. All the references I kept seeing were to great works which had been able to tell us what was happening to us now from what we knew from the past. It's the most powerful way of understanding the present.
It is. I actually haven't read Robbie Arnott's new book. I read the last one,
Flames.
I think. Flames, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. It's one of the best first novels I've read in ages. Australian first novels I've read in ages. It's a great book. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I think is really interesting is that I feel like I talked about this in an article a while ago, but I mean, I do feel like the process of getting to grips with where we are with climate is a bit like the kind of stages of grieving. You know, it's that kind of sense that people respond to what is very bad news by, first of all, they begin with denial, then they get angry, then it's kind of bargaining, and, you know, eventually they kind of reach a space of kind of acceptance. And I think, you know, and that's because it's, you know, it's really hard to think about. It's really hard to get to grips with. And you know, I've been through all of those stages. I've watched other people go through them. And I do think that one of the things that fiction helps people do is to find them, you know, find their way to that kind of space of, I guess, kind of acceptance, that space of recognizing the reality of things. And then, you know, which seems to me to be a really good place to get people to, because if you can get people to that place, then you can start having kind of honest conversations about where we are. But, you know, so much of that process of moving through things, of getting past kind of anger and fear, is about just kind of, you know, being able to think about it in a clear way, being able to imagine where we're going to be. And you know, like I say, I think fiction is something that lets you do that by letting you escape from that dissonance, by letting you just kind of sit with it for a while. I think you can often move towards a kind of place of acceptance. And I think that's something that happens with grief all over. I mean, one of the things I'm very aware of is that when I, you know, I mean, I know that I always know when things are really bad in my life because I find myself reading nature books and I find myself reading David Bowie and Beatles biographies. But, you know, but the nature books are kind of for a reason because there's something about that kind of, there's a kind of ethic embodied in a lot of nature writing, this kind of sense that what the language and the book is trying to do is engage in a process of noticing, a process of just being in the world, that kind of sense that the language is taking you closer to things. And I always find that very reassuring, that kind of capacity for language and fiction to kind of reassure us and steady us and make us feel, I can see what's here.
Mm. Yes, and the steps out to the next part are laid by someone being beside you and having written about it and having explained to you how you've been feeling because they're feeling the same way. James,
I was going to say absolutely. And I mean, I actually think one of the things that's been really interesting over the last few months with COVID, but more generally, is I think a lot of people, when they think about things like climate and things like that, they think about, you know, there's all these kind of fantasies of we need to run away and live in a bunker. And that's actually not what we need to do. What we need to do is we need to find empathy. We need to find kindness. You know, we need to find kind of communal answers and look to each other for support. You know, and when I was talking before about this all being very difficult, I do think it is very difficult. You know, and that's one of the things that you actually need people around you to understand. You know, you need people to recognize that often this stuff is really hard and people find it difficult to get to grips with it, and we need as kind of human beings to kind of reach out to each other for that. And as you said, that's one of the things that fiction can do. You know, it is someone else who's already been there and has been thinking about it. So, yeah.
Well, James, you reach out to us with this book and you offer us a path into thinking about things more deeply and maybe more honestly. But I know that it's been crafted in the face of loss. So I'm sorry about your recent losses. But I do think that some of that has infused this book with a beautiful delicacy as well as a real urgency. So thank you very much for the book. And also thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Sydney Writers Festival thanks the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund for supporting the writers involved in making this podcast. We'd love you to consider making a tax-deductible donation to help safeguard the future of Sydney Writers Festival. Your support will help ensure that next year, we're back at the festival, side by side, listening to exceptional storytellers, inspiring readers, and celebrating writers.